Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome to Opera Night at the Boston Public Library. My name is Julie House. I'm the Education and Community Programs Manager for Boston Lyric Opera, and it is our pleasure to be one of your hosts this evening, along with our partners, the Boston Public Library. We've been partnering with the BPL on this series now for 9 seasons. We are taking a bit of a departure tonight from our regularly scheduled programming around Peter Maxwell Davies' The Lighthouse. Much like our televisions will be preempted at 9 p.m. tonight for the President's State of the Union, we are here for a conversation about the state of the art, the state of what it's like producing opera in Boston. What are the unique challenges? What are the unique opportunities that we have in this city? What aspects of these challenges and opportunities are shared by large companies, small companies, and educational institutions? And for the fullest picture possible of these questions, we've assembled the panel that you see before you. Regrettably, we did have a last-minute cancellation, and Gil Rose is not able to join us tonight. But I will introduce the panelists that we have here, who I know you'll enjoy hearing from. I'll start at the far end of the table with Sharon Daniels. She is the director of the Opera Institute at Boston University. The Opera Institute is an intensive, highly selective, 2-year performance-based training program for operatic artists. Through their professional curriculum model, singers have the opportunity to participate in 2 main stage productions with a full orchestra, a fringe festival of significant one-act operas, and outreach programs. Ms. Daniels enjoyed a 25-year operatic career based primarily at New York City Opera and a Broadway run and PBS Great Performances production of The Most Happy Fella. Next to Ms. Daniels is Esther Nelson, General and Artistic Director of Boston Lyric Opera. She joined the company in September 2008 after a successful tenure as General Director and CEO of Glimmerglass Opera in Cooperstown, New York. She has also held management roles at New Orleans Opera and Nevada Opera, served as a panelist for the National Endowment for the Arts, and as a management consultant for a broad range of clients, including the New York Historical Association and the European International Music and Arts Foundation. To her left is Aliana De La Guardia. Ms. De La Guardia is the general manager of Guerrilla Opera, an ensemble in residence at the Boston Conservatory with a mission to foster a new repertoire of progressive and accessible operas written specifically for them and perform them in intimate theatrical settings without a conductor. Ms. De La Guardia is a classical singer herself who specializes in contemporary performance techniques and repertoire of the 20th and 21st centuries. Finally, our moderator this evening, balancing out the panel, our all-female panel, is Adam Ragusa. He is a composer by training, but Mr. Ragusa got his start in radio as a classical music announcer at WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. From there, he moved into news and ended his tenure as the interim news director. He came to WBUR in the summer of 2008, first as a fill-in anchor and then in the newsroom. He brings particular passions for urban planning, transportation, and fortunately for us, arts and culture, topics to his work on Radio Boston. We will have ample opportunity for questions at the end, but right now, why don't we hear from our panel? Adam.
Thank you for the kind introduction, Julie. I would amend that short biographical sketch to mention that in 1999, when I was 17 years old, I was a student at the Boston University Tanglewood Institute.
All right.
known as Booty to us, and I imagine still by the kids who go there.
Yes, it is.
I don't have to tell you that it was a heady and wonderful experience. It was my first time coming through Boston. It was my first time seeing the Berkshires, and the Berkshires in July when you're 17 is a pretty enchanting experience. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, what a cool place. All these cool, strong arts institutions, and it's all orbits, you know, this beautiful, all this wonderful natural beauty, and it all orbits around this metropolis that's got so much going on in Boston. And I remember thinking, man, I wish I could live there one day. I mentioned this not just to point out how great my life is going. I hope your life is going pretty well. But I mention this for the following reason. We are having this conversation this evening in the midst of winter in more ways than one, and may we all take a moment to thank our lucky stars that we live in Boston. Yes. Applause for Boston. All right. The conversation we're about to have is going to last about, we're 10 minutes into our hour. We're going to reserve about 20 minutes at the end for audience questions. And when I say questions, I do mean questions, not manifesti with question marks tacked on to the end. We have an enormous amount of knowledge represented in our panel here, and may we all avail ourselves of it. Fair warning, we are recording this right now for WBUR. If you don't want your voice recorded, then I would not approach one of these microphones. Our conversation tonight will by no means be limited to the demise of Opera Boston, but it is nonetheless occasioned by it. And therefore, so that we all have a common basis of factual understanding for what we're going to talk about, I will briefly recount what we know about what happened based on the work of a number of reporters. Opera Boston officially ceased operations on the first of the year with only 1 week's public notice. The company was anticipating $250,000 to a $1 million debt, depending on who talked to which reporter when. This is all relative to a $2.5 million projected annual budget. Ticket sales were, relatively speaking, robust, but the company had no endowment and primarily relied upon the largesse of a handful of board members, most significantly a man named Randolph Fuller.
Here.
How's it going? According to reporting by my friend Jeff Edgers at The Globe, the relationship between Mr. Fuller and General Director Leslie Koenig had soured. He at least partially withdrew his support, and there were some other power conflicts within the board, prompting some resignations. And a grant that everyone was hoping for didn't come through, and the remaining board members decided to throw in the towel. If anyone here disputes the account on the basis of firsthand knowledge, please feel free to talk to me and any other interested parties after the...
I dispute a great deal of that, but this is your event.
All right. Well, this is what the public record shows as of now, and I look forward to having the opportunity to amend the public record on new information once it is presented to me. Esther, I will ask you simply, could what happened to Opera Boston happen to the BLO?
Yes, it could happen to the BLO. It can happen to most any other cultural organization. When we live in a country which is, actually, I don't mean this negatively, but the norm for opera companies is that our income from earned income, ticket sales, is 2/3. The rest, in fact, is raised. That is a ratio that is a dangerous ratio if, in fact, you do not have the foundation of, say, an endowment or multi-year gifts of a significant size. So it is, and I think I'm getting some notices. It's the wrong ratio? I'm wishful thinking here. It is 1/3. Let me correct this. 1/3 is the norm of opera companies. So that said, if you're a company of a middle size, like we are, say 7 million, 2/3 is a lot of millions that you have to raise on an annual basis. So yes, but we are by no means the only one that goes for theaters, that goes for orchestras, it goes sometimes for museums. We all are in a precarious situation at times.
That said, there were a number of structural differences between the BLO and Opera Boston, and I wonder if you might go through some of those.
I would say that we started pretty much where Opera Boston was 35 years ago. And you grow carefully, slowly, and with the generosity of donors. In the beginning of every company like that, it is largely major donors who make it possible for you to exist in the first place. So gradually you build yourself a foundation, but that in fact does take time. And particularly as you grow, as we are at 35 years old, and also I would say that the difference here is that we, the Boston Lyric Opera, from the very beginning, our mission embraced the totality of opera. That means not only the smaller chamber works and the lesser known, but also your Toscas, your Carmens, and they're significantly bigger.
Sure.
And so your expense, of course, is much higher. So if you want to embrace the entire width and breadth of opera, that means that you essentially have to gradually and very carefully build a wide foundation. Still, nonetheless, it's a patron-driven art, but I want to say it's not an art for the patrons. It's patrons making it possible for the community. And every healthy community should have a variety of whether it's operas or symphonies or theaters or museums. But not only the traditional, the bigger ones that, like we, that do in fact embrace the entire breadth, but also alternatives. Boston was extremely lucky to have had two full professional opera companies for a city of this size. That is very rare. And the only reason that could happen in the first place is that you had major donors who were willing to make it happen. That said, I think a rich community has a wide variety, and we have that here in Boston. I would say the one thing I want to really say from the very beginning, I think it is a vibrant opera town. In fact, the fact that it had two professional companies is proof that this is an opera town. But, and it has this breadth, and largely it is because I think of the many, many wonderful educational institutions.
Well, speaking of variety, a common media narrative around the Opera Boston demise, and I will accept my news organization's share of complicity in establishing or promulgating this narrative, is that Opera Boston was the plucky, innovative, small company doing contemporary works, doing works from the dustbin of history, whereas the BLO was the big and stuffy formulaic institution catering to the WGBH three tenors special watching
Can
Josh
I comment
Groban
on that?
Christmas album buying public.
Oh, can I comment on that?
Would you like someone from the outside to comment?
I would like to talk about to what extent that is accurate, and I think that someone other than Esther should
take a look at the season next year and try to say that. I mean, they're doing this coming year. They're in the middle of rehearsals for The Lighthouse. Then, yes, they're going to do a Barber of Seville. Last year, there was a wonderful Handel piece. It was done in a very unusual way. And then, is the Inspector a premiere? Or it's
the first time that it's done by a larger company.
It was
actually opened at Wolf Trap, which is a small company. It's a new work. It's a new American work. And last year, I can go through the last 3 years and say that, in fact, I think about a fourth of our last 3 years were what I would consider traditional. It's the press loves to polarize things, and you know it for a very good reason, because that you have to somehow put it all on one common denominator. But at the same time, I would say that Opera Boston, and Randolph, please correct me, did not only do the lesser known and esoteric and contemporary. They too did some of the standard works once in a while. So it was, Fidelio is not exactly what you call, rare, and a rare work, nor a small one, for that matter. So I think we have a mission that our missions are different, but that doesn't exclude the works of one or the other. And I think the sad part to me is that what came out a little bit is you're either traditional, which we aren't, but you're the bigger company, ergo traditional, so you're financially responsible and therefore boring, or you are exciting and energetic and young and fiscally irresponsible. Neither is true.
Aliana, you are exciting and young and energetic. Are you also fiscally irresponsible?
I don't think we are, no, we're not. I mean, we've been around we're a young company, but we've been around for 5 years, and we're still going, and we look forward to many more seasons to come, and we feel confident that we can be around for many more seasons to come.
For those who don't know, could you explain your model in some detail?
The model for our company?
Yeah.
We're a nonprofit organization, and also what Guerrilla Opera is specifically is we're an ensemble of artists, and we commission operas to be performed specifically by us thereby creating our own unique repertoire of operas.
Where does the money come from?
We have a board of directors, and we have events sometimes, and we do annual appeals for donations from people. Same thing as most large companies do.
Are you on staff? Are you on staff, or do you have full-time staff with the company?
No, we're very small. Everybody is a volunteer, except now when we perform frequently, we're compensated. But there's still a lot of elbow grease and overtime working and volunteer things happening. So we're still in the growth period.
Well, I think that leads us to a question that I would like to hear all of you take a stab at. I'd like to ask, to what extent can we expect Opera Boston's market share to be absorbed by the existing or surviving opera institutions in this city? Cher?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Well, they were putting on operas and people were going to them, and they were putting on a certain type of opera, mm-hmm. although, as we've established, the media narrative was a bit of an oversimplification, but nonetheless, they demonstrated a desire in the market for innovative programming. To what extent will that market share be absorbed by the BLO and by other players?
I guess the reason I didn't quite understand it is that my vision, my perception of the opera audience, albeit market, in this city is that it is an incredibly supportive audience that goes to everything. I'm looking out here today and I'm seeing all my buddies that come to all the operas and the Fringe Festival at BU, and I go to BLO or I go to Opera Boston and I see the same crowd. Now, it may not be the same donors. It may be people who support specific kinds of opera growth, but I think there's a considerable amount of collaboration and support for all of the opera markets here. I mean, my colleagues and I will go to Aliana's things and to Boston Opera Collaborative, and one of the features of the Opera America conference that was held here last year was the very fact that we are such a diverse and supportive opera community. So I also want to just express a terrific sadness that Opera Boston is not in existence, because I think it had a very, very special gift to our community, and not because it's better than or different than or whatever. It had a very special group of artists that got together to do their special job, and I think that in all the cases, if you had a round table of more of the other opera companies, or if you had two or three of the people from BLO, you would hear this basically wonderful artistic energy that comes around projects. And I don't think we have to be in competition. In fact, well, I don't see that.
Your answer seems to suggest that the listening public will take as much opera as they can get.
I think so. HD included.
All right. Esther, is there something that the BLO can take or can do now that its competitor, and I put that in quotation marks, has been eliminated?
I consider them partner as well as good competitors. There's nothing wrong with having good competition. But yes, we were approached actually by the board leadership of Opera Boston to see what we can do to help with their subscribers, who of course have two more shows to go, and so we, in fact, as we speak, and probably already it's out today, we have an offer to all of the subscribers from Opera Boston who purchased tickets this year with a multi-tiered approach, with a multi-tier offer to come to up to a BLO. And in fact, you're right. There's a large group that really come to everything. And, you know, opera fans are very passionate. In that sense, I will say, I think there's a difference sometimes between opera fans and not to at all dismiss theater and symphony and some of the other wonderful cultural arts, but there's a certain passion that resides with opera fans that I sometimes find linked a little bit to, or coming from Europe, to real passionate soccer fans or baseball. And so there is a certain passion, which is wonderful. And there is that loss, of this other player in the community. Mm-hmm. But yes, we will be reaching out. And we find it quite interesting that there is an overlap, but there was also a core that went to Opera Boston that would not come, as I'm sure you have among yours, who might not come to our productions or to the university. I mean, we go to each other's productions as much as we can and enjoy them on many, many levels.
Yeah, Eliana, to what extent does your audience overlap, you think, with the audience to the other opera entities in the city?
Well, I think that there's definitely overlap. What we do is definitely opera. What we do is also very close to theater, so I think we have a certain demographic in our audience that are theater goers. I think there's a lot of young people that come to our shows as well, and I think that's not just because we ourselves that put on our show are young people, but I think it's because we tell our stories from that viewpoint, I think, and that attracts people.
To a certain extent, Opera Boston and your let's start with Opera Boston. To a certain extent, Opera Boston was able to do some things that the BLO was not, and please, anyone correct me if I'm wrong, because it was not fully unionized. That was something that impacted the cost of doing business. I wonder... And then we go to a company like yours, Eliana, which is entirely volunteer. Mm-hmm. You're getting paid a little bit now, and I'm sure that's wonderful.
Pays the coffee.
It's great.
Who doesn't love money? If we look at the parallel development in popular music over the last couple of years, certainly since the appearance of online file sharing in the scene, I think that the story has been about air coming out of the balloon, about a lot of the money leaving the system, and to a certain extent, the field being deprofessionalized. And I wonder if you see what you're doing with your company being part of a parallel development in opera to a certain extent. Are there just going to be just as many people doing it, but fewer people making money doing it in the future?
We hope not.
That's an excellent question.
Thank you. I get paid for this.
I think that depends on why people are doing it and why the bulk of people are doing it. Guerrilla Opera does it because we were artists that wanted to make our art together. And we wanted to do that by producing opera, by telling stories. I think that if you are starting a group that does opera just to do opera, maybe that will peter out, and I think that will be hard for you to sustain because there are so many groups that do opera just to do opera, and I think that's where the commercial sort of YouTube aspect is there, that people are just out there doing it to do it, but their mission is not so solid.
When I was studying composition at university, I was joking with our panelists in the green room saying that I've flunked out or dropped out of some of the finest schools of music in this country. I've dropped out of a graduate program at Indiana University, a school with a wonderful opera program. In part because I came to feel that I was the victim of a pyramid scheme, that my only way of making money with what I was learning to do would be to teach other people to do it. So I wonder, at Boston University, are your students expecting to make a living? To what extent are they expecting to make a living?
Yes, I would say so. In fact, if we look at our numbers from the Institute over the last 10 years, we have a very nice record of people that are at the Metropolitan and that are working in Europe. Arturo Chacon Cruz, Sandra Pizzetti, Morris Robinson, I could list a number of people that have come through our program and gone through the Metropolitan Opera auditions here. And I think one of the things that is challenging is that opera is changing. I mean, whether you talk about it being, a group that has the blood and guts to do what Aliana is doing, whether it is BLO or whether it's what's going to happen to us all because of HD, what is happening at the Met, what happened to my beloved New York City Opera. I mean, what is going to happen to all these artists that are becoming so accomplished and are entering a market that is shrinking? And what is going to become of us all? Some of my colleagues in many schools have not gone through the rigors of the career, but the career itself is different now. And we all have to look at, what happens to an audience that has the up-close and personal experience of an HD performance and then comes into an acoustical space that even at the Met is disappointing because we're so used to the grand...
The close-up.
The close-up and the acoustical close-up of those voices. So it's going to be a very interesting time. And I think in the educating of young artists, young opera artists of all kinds and... including state set designers and costume designers.
Shout out.
I think we all have to keep a very open mind and keep growing because there's no telling what's going to happen. And it's very exciting, but it's also kind of scary.
Well, back to the particular conditions in Boston, to what extent is growth of opera in our city constrained by the fact that we don't have a dedicated opera house?
That's a good question. We need an acoustical space. We do.
I think what we don't have, we have an opera house. It just doesn't have any opera in it.
Yeah, we have Dirty Dancing there.
But we are handicapped by not having a facility that allows us to do the larger works. In fact, grand opera is not possible in any of the spaces available to us.
For the reason being there's no large orchestra pit. Is that the big reason?
Well, the Opera House actually did enlarge its orchestra pit to about 80.
Oh, it does?
If you want to have your perfect list of what would you like, there is no facility like it in the city. That said, I think because actually opera is a little bit behind the curve, it did have a fabulous opera house, it was torn down. But by being behind the curve, maybe Boston can be on the forefront and be ahead of the curve. So I think as we're all looking at the current situation and wondering whether we are going to have fewer opportunities because we're also concentrating on a company that's gone under, let me point out that about 20 years ago in America, there was far less opera than there is today. So eventually the market does drive what's going on too, and people, when they want it, will find a way of getting it. And I think there is just absolutely terrific opportunity. Down the road, if we had a wish list, what do we want? I think we want a wonderful facility in the future that accommodates not only grand opera that we would like to do and this community wants, but also a multi-space that where, in fact, we could have the smaller companies doing what they're doing so that the same audience gets to experience a full spectrum and not the high temple of art. To me, they are actually 19th century, 18th century's legacies that are passed. It no longer reflects our society of today. I think that the space should be available and a friendly destination space all day long, where you can go and have a brown bag lunch and maybe see a rehearsal in process, where you get to talk and interact with an artist, whether it be one of the artists from the different groups or one of our own. And where maybe the university students could come and actually interact as well and have an experience. I think the time has come for a model like that. And Boston, and we certainly are at Boston Lyric Opera, and our board are thinking in those terms. But I think we no longer can afford to say, we need a grand house. No, we, the community, need something that you all will benefit from.
She sounds like she's kicking off a capital campaign, doesn't she?
I have to say that even in the resources that are available, BLO is already reaching out to the university. We have some wonderful collaborative efforts going on, and our artists are in the rehearsals at BLO, et cetera. So I thank Esther for that, because I think it's very visionary.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I wanted to add to that. I feel like within the opera industry, there's this stigma that if you're not producing grand opera, then you're really just not producing anything at all. And I just think that couldn't possibly be true. There are so many different kinds of theater. Why can't there be as many kinds of opera that are just as artistically viable? You know, why is fringe opera considered less than grand opera? It's not less, it's just different. And the audience is smaller, but that doesn't mean that the audience is less special or that they're less taken care of. It's a different way to explore the genre of opera that's just as artistically pleasing as grand opera. And if we can't produce grand opera here, then why can't we be producing everything else that's just as important, you know?
We're a little more than halfway through our time, so if anyone wants to think about asking a question, now would be the time to start lining up at the microphones, and we encourage it greatly. Notwithstanding the very compelling case that you just made for small opera, back on the topic of large opera, I joked about a capital campaign, but I imagine that the effort to build a new opera facility in a city like Boston would be a nine-figure effort. Is anyone talking about doing that? Are there circles where this is being discussed?
In Boston?
Yeah.
I think just on the periphery, because I think before you launch something like that, you have to make sure that the company that is on the forefront of looking into that is financially viable and healthy. And that requires you to have foundation, healthy foundation, capitalization. It requires you to be very solid, as much as a performing arts company can be solid. And that brings me to another point. I think, you know, in Europe, about 80% of many of the companies are funded by public sources. People are taxed, so it's not the government just giving you money. You are simply taxed. And here in America, we've opted for individual contributions, because most of our annual budgets, maybe 1% comes from public funding. And but part of that is that it does keep you on your toes. It when you don't know where next year is going to come from and where the funding is, you're going to be very creative. And sometimes those companies end up actually with more creativity, because I think art, when something is secure, it can become deadly. So I'd like more money, we'd like a lot more funding, but I think there is something to be said about this model and keeping us on the edge, because we're constantly looking for new ways, and innovation is what makes art interesting, not doing the expected all the time.
Shall we start taking some questions from the audience? Come on down. And if you could introduce yourself before you go to your question. Hey, ma'am.
My name is Dahlia Geffen. I'm the president of the Boston Wagner Society. I would like to ask Ms. Nelson how the Ring Cycle in 1983 was staged by the BLO if grand opera cannot be done in Boston.
It was done with reduced forces. When I'm talking about grand opera, I mean doing them in the forces, musical forces, that the piece calls for. And I wasn't there then. I cannot address to what extent they were reduced, but they were reduced.
So it wasn't actually grand.
It was a 60-piece orchestra.
Okay, there you are.
Orchestration done by the great Angelo Neumann in the 19th century.
Right, that it was a reduced forces. It, again, approved by Richard Wagner, but if we wanted to do, for instance, a Staying with Wagner, a Tristan and Isolde, or any of the other bigger Wagners that I know your fans would love us to do, we would need a different facility.
Who wants more Wagner? All right. Thank you very much.
I had another
question. Oh, you have another follow-up? Go ahead.
Yes, this is about the Constellation Center. I don't know how many of you know about this, but there's a plan for 4 performance spaces in Kendall Square. The plans have all been drawn up. They're acoustically just marvelous. Why is this not moving forward? Why are there not enough donors to make this happen? Does anybody know?
Not we. I couldn't possibly comment. I'm aware of it, but not aware of why it isn't moving in a certain direction. Nor have
Thank
we
you.
Been asked.
You, sir.
Thanks. David Berry. So not to oversimplify, but listening to much of today, I was hearing a trend of what is happening to opera and what is happening to the opera community. I'd be interested in getting your perspectives on what you, your organizations, the opera community as a whole can do proactively to redefine the opera for the future so that some of the current issues that the community is facing today don't come back.
That's a good question. Who wants it?
I think that when you go to the opera, you should tell people that you go to the opera and bring other people to the opera and encourage people to go. The best form of marketing there is word of mouth. And if you're going to the opera and not telling anybody you're going to the opera and not encouraging anybody else to go, then how are we expected to reach a larger audience? And if you're a young person and you've been to the opera and you want to give it another shot, then why do you, you know, why don't you bring some friends with you and make a night of it? Or, you know, if you're scared to approach a larger company, start with a smaller, you know, like work your way up. You know, I think the main thing is that people need to be encouraging other people to go to the opera and to be proud to go to the opera, you know?
I think maybe you're also asking us what we can do, yes? Or something. I'll just say one thing that I think making the public aware what is happening, what we're on a big campaign to do is to let everybody know what an inexpensive ticket we have at BU for some wonderful, wonderful opera that is with fresh young voices, that's just fun theater, and sometimes we do standard works and sometimes we do crazy works. But I think getting the word out that this is an approachable, interesting, comfortable place to be is one of the ways that, at least in a university setting, not unlike what Aliana's talking about, that where people can come and they don't spend so much for a ticket, because our costs are not the same, because we have students who build the sets, and as glamorous as they might be, by some of our set designers. I think that's one way that we contribute to the community, is to then break down a barrier for the person who wants to then say, well, maybe I want to go hear a person that is 10 years advanced in their training sing that same role.
And I think as far as we're concerned, we are doing much for the opera of the future. As I said, we are doing a contemporary American piece. We're doing The Lighthouse, which is certainly not standard. Certainly, anyone who's seen our Macbeth, while it might be more standard repertory, could not be considered a standard production. And in fact, we're still having heated debates back and forth on both sides of the fence. But I think what we need to bring to the table is we need to be viable as an art form, and we need to be earnest about it. And we certainly are, and they are as well. And many of the other opera producers who are not here on the panel today, by the way, there are lots more opera producers in this community, viable producers, and concert were operas. I think that the community is doing it, and it does come back to the community. It takes not a village, it takes a town. And I think much of the negativity that seems to be spinning out actually is not deserved. There is a lot of positive in opera in this community. Spread the word. And because the community will respond, if there's lots of press that is negative, then the community will talk negative, and then funders will be negative too. It's a defeating purpose. One I will say is not deserved in this community.
You, sir.
Hello, I'm Joe Gakin from East Boston. First of all, thank you for many memorable nights at the opera. Macbeth saw it. Mr. Fuller, thank you for all you've done. Mahagani, De Freischütz, Bartered Bride, all these wonderful things. My question, very felicitous segue, is audience development. Do you have specifically Boston Lyric Opera, have an affinity group for people, say, under the age of 45? How does that work? What are the moves management like, the touches? And what is somewhat interested in opera hedge fund manager gets a group of friends together for one night, and where does it go after that? Is it like, oh, you're going to subscribe for next year, or Cosi Van Tutti, what kind of sorbet is that? Could you please let me know?
I think we're doing... Well, first of all, we do have a lot of younger subscribers. That said, you have to be also realistic that for most companies, you're a little bit older when you transition to the larger opera companies. So don't beat your head against the wall as a company and trying to achieve the unattainable. That said, though, we do have a student subscriber group. In fact, it was our marketing director who said, let's stop doing just student subscriptions at 50% off. Why don't we make subscribers out of them? Because once it's a habit. So once you're a subscriber, you also get a letter, guess what? Could you possibly donate a little bit to it? But it's a very different world we live in, and we all struggle to adjust to that. And it's a fast-paced world, particularly in electronic communication. And so it takes some adjustment for us, but we're doing it. If you look at our website, our students have a Twitter lounge. I didn't even know what Twitter was when we started the Twitter lounge, but I'm learning. So the first thing you have to do is hire a lot of young employees who really know all this language. So we are doing it, and I think we have to do it increasingly on multiple levels, and that's the challenge of a bigger company, that we have to appeal to Aliana's group somehow as much as we can. We have to appeal to the students and pull them in. We have to appeal to an older audience. We have to appeal to a younger audience. And increasingly, the society we live in is becoming more and more segmented. There isn't one way of communication that appeals to all. That's a challenge when you have a limited budget. But I think we are trying our very best, and we do see results.
Well, Esther, you hinted at something, which is that there are really two challenges here. One is to foster the audience of the future. The other is to foster the donors of the future. It's not just getting them in, it's getting them to give, because we have just seen what can happen when a donor base, as generous as it is, as valuable, as wonderful it is too narrow, is insufficiently wide. Which
I think
means
that's,
narrow.
I think that is very sort of far common of younger companies. When you start out, you tend to have three or four, and then eventually, as I said earlier, you grow, you hope. But I think, again, let me just briefly say, as a European, that is the difference between America and Europe. America is based on a system of philanthropy that is actually left to the individual. It's not left to the government, it's not left to the city, it's not only left to foundation, it's every one of you sitting here. And that is something that increasingly where we feel a disconnect in younger generations, that it's more generation of what do you give me rather than what are you giving us, what are you giving back to us so we can serve your community. And that's a problem.
Well, this is the question for Aliana. How do you... What is your average donor like, and how do you solicit them?
Yeah.
In other words, do you want to divulge all your development secrets?
Our average donors right now are in the older demographic, but as we find, we've been around for 5 years. As our audience gets older, because they come to us when they're young, and as they get older, we start getting, you know, some small amounts in the mail, maybe sometimes through our website, and it's not a lot, but it's something. And that tells us that there's people watching what we're doing, and there's people that care about what we're doing, and they can't give a lot, but they're doing what they can. Like, for example, if sometimes on Facebook or on Twitter, I find that there's free tickets to... I don't know, some open dress rehearsal or other, and I go, great, I'll get my free tickets, but then I feel bad, so I go online and I give them $5 or $10, you know, and that's that's the beginning, you know. And should I ever have more money to give, I will give more money, because that's something I value.
Well, to what extent can the philanthropy be built into the ticket price? For instance, I went and saw a folk show at Club Passim last night, and the ticket price was $28, which for something like that was pretty steep. But I thought of it, I'm a patron of the arts, no problem.
Well, Guerrilla Opera specifically, we are really sort of adamant about keeping our ticket prices low. We want people of all kinds to be able to come and see our show, and we don't want someone who's young, who's just graduated from college, just started a job, to see that our tickets are, you know, $28 and be like, whoa, that's, you know, I can't, like, because when you go out to the theater, then you also go out to dinner, and then you go see a show, and then maybe you go out to drinks after the show. So it's not just $28. It's actually probably closer to $60 or more. And we want people who are, we want people of all kinds who are at any place in their life to be able to come to our show and make a night of our show and not feel like it's such a financial burden. That being said, we also recognize that we're the kind of company that can do that, and not all companies can do that. There are larger companies, and they have larger expenses. We feel like with our low ticket prices, we can cultivate donors that way by saying, well, you know, I didn't pay that much for the show, and I can give them $10 extra online, or I can throw it in the box after the show or something.
Just a quick update. We're doing pretty well on time. We have about 12 minutes left, and we have two questioners lined up. We could probably have time for one or two more in addition to these two. So if anyone has a question, get in the queue. You, ma'am.
Hi there. I hear a lot about conservative growth and very traditional funding models, whether that's reliance on a donor base or an educational institution. But I'm really interested in hearing where you see the leaders are in innovative financial models and where that might come from, and how that might be possibly separate from the story that's woven through the fundraising.
I think we all are looking at different models, and there are many out there. And I alluded to something earlier for the larger companies, because when you are larger, your flexibility, of course, diminishes. And so much of that is that we need to have a more solid funding base. And the old school said an endowment and your problems are all solved. The endowment will solve an awful lot of problems if you have one, but that's not the only problem, because you actually also want to have some money available for artistic flexibility. As I said earlier, because you need to allow energy to try something different. And I will say an example of us was our opera Annex, which some of you may be familiar with. That's a fourth production that we do, but it's in an alternate space. It's not actually in a theater. Very complex, you might not think so, but it is. But we started that, and we had the good fortune of having several of our board members saying, well, then we're going to start a fund that is dedicated to doing those kind of things that you feel the company should do that addresses some of the community needs that we can't in a traditional funding model. So we did that, but then you have to replenish that all the time. So we are endlessly coming up with creative ways of accomplishing another fundraising goal, but it is to that end. And so again, there are multiple levels that you need to think about. And you mentioned earlier in terms of our costs and union. Let me just say that we have about, for an average of the larger shows, about 130 to 140 people on the payroll that are not staff. That's a lot of artists. You know, by the time you have a full chorus, by the time you have your orchestra, by the time you have your principal artists, by the time you have your designers, by the time, and. These are all professionals. They need to be paid. Out of those, only about 13 or 14 come from outside of the community. We're pumping all of that money back into the community. Our sets are being built by ART Shop. Our costumes are built by Costume Works. That is not a traditional model. Traditional opera model was, we're going to go to some set shop, God knows where, and we're going to do bids and bring it in, and then we're going to go to a costume shop somewhere else. We're actually bringing things into Boston. That's what the economic collapse forced us to do. Good thing, isn't it? So there we have flexibility. We don't have the flexibility not to pay any of the professional singers, and we shouldn't. That's why unions were created, honestly, in the first place. We don't have that flexibility, and we shouldn't have that flexibility. It takes more time for a singer to be able to have a professional career and invest in his or her training than it does sometimes to become a doctor. And yet,
don't we all know that?
And our society seems to sometimes think, I cannot tell you how many times we hear, can you just throw a couple of singers in for free?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, throw me in there sometime, you'll see why.
Okay. We might throw him in there in the future, now I learn. But yes, so I think there are funding models are required, and we are trying very hard to be nimble as much as we can be.
Ma'am.
Hi there, my name is Sarah Morrow, and I'm an opera singer here in town and also a founder of a nonprofit organization. So my question is directed at you, Eliana. One of the things we've struggled with, we're called the Diva Day Foundation, and we put on operas and we benefit.
Well, I saw you were Selka, actually.
Thank you.
explain a little more what you do.
We benefit women's advocacy groups. We're a women's advocacy group. So we feature female artists. We donate our proceeds to women's shelters. Obviously, a lot of what we're talking about is also true for us, and being young and being very grassroots like you guys are. I'm curious, one of our biggest challenges is creating that board, you know? Like, of course, you know, like your question is also the solicitation and how do we get our donors to contribute. And luckily, a lot of women in the community that know of us do contribute to us because we're sort of different from opera companies, being a women's advocacy group. But my question is, like, who are your board members? Where did they come from? You don't have to tell me who they are specifically, but you know. And same, I'm a member of Boston Opera Collaborative, and any young artist group needs a board. And you know, a lot of us are transitioning from having an internal board and an external board, and finding people who want to be on a board. Like, how does that fully happen?
Well,
do you know
I spent
I mean?
Some time this morning looking through Mitt Romney's tax returns. I believe he's in Florida. If you want to catch up with him,
oh, that's a good idea. I'll hit him up.
Yeah. I would say that board cultivation is one of those things that is slowly and carefully. I think you need a goal for your board. Who do you want on your board, and what do you want them to do for you? There's a lot of young organizations that start out with just the founding artists on their board. That's okay to start, and it's okay to keep them there.
Yeah, oh,
but you gotta add
right.
other people who mm-hmm. are not necessarily the administrators or producers that are in your company.
Of course.
So, for example, like major donors will be on your board, people who are very enthusiastic about you, people who will donate services.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Those kind of people, and like I said, it's a struggle, but it's a slow thing, and you really have to be patient.
Yeah, the process is the hardest part.
We're still being patient.
I think that leads us to a question that is very much of the now, which is what.
We'll talk more after if you still have.
Okay.
If you still have questions,
I'm good. Thanks.
The question is, what can your board members, or I really mean your major donors, what can or should they expect from you?
That question
also a great
anybody.
Question.
Anybody?
Transparency, I think, is one. Remember that we administrators inherit a mission statement and a mission of the company that we need to identify with and want to fulfill. We don't own that. That mission is owned by the board of directors. It is the responsibility of the board of directors. It is in their interest. And we, as managers, artistic and otherwise, need to fulfill as best we can that particular mission. We then need to inspire our board and funders that that is what we're doing, but we also owe them the transparency in terms of management. What is it, where are the pitfalls? And the respect that a board member and a donor deserves. But that said, it's not a playing forum for board members either, in terms, so their respect goes both ways. And so I have to say I'm extremely fortunate that I have a board that is wonderful in all of those ways. So that's very fortunate. It doesn't always happen.
Not that this is sensitive territory at all. We've got about 5 minutes left. Let's try to get through our last two questions here. You, ma'am.
Okay, my name is Eve Budnick. I'm the artistic director for Opera Del West, another small company, 6 years. And my question is, when I was reading up about Opera Boston, I kept wondering why it was that there wasn't a way to trim back. I mean, everything I do is shoestring budget, you know, Salvation Army, that kind of thing for costumes. If you were having a bad year in terms of donors, is there a way that a larger company can sort of pull things back or do smaller productions? I'm just curious.
It's a
that.
Great question, and one that has sat with me for this last, it was almost a month ago. You know, one of the things about Opera Boston's fall that puzzled me was that there was no
fair warning given. There was no one ever dropped a dime to my friend Jeff or to me and to say, hey, Opera Boston is this close. It's on the edge. Raising the hand, raising the alarm. And it gave the impression, and I think the mayor even alluded to this, the impression that Opera Boston didn't just sink, that it was maybe even scuttled. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but I thought that it was strange the way that it went down. So let me ask you, Esther, this. If you were in a similar position, if you were, you know, you were facing a budget deficit that was half of your operating budget, what would you do? What would be your emergency plan? You know, your break glass in case of option.
Well, let me say that the bigger you are, often the less flexibility you have. And Opera Boston, while it was smaller, was still a professional company, fully professional. I think that you have to realize that in our world, when you start sounding, first of all, in terms of expense reduction, when your season's on the way, there are certain obligations and contracts that a professional company has engaged in that you simply have to honor. So it's not so easy. You might go into a situation where you want to do a concert versus a full production, but chances are you already have expensed some of that production. And I'm talking about us. I am not at all at liberty, nor do I have information about Opera Boston. But let me answer a little bit more. But I do want to point out again that any further questions directly related to Opera Boston, I'm sure Mr. Fuller would be happy to answer afterwards. But good. So, but let me also say that in our business, when you actually raise the warn signal that we're having a serious problem, guess what happens? Rarely does the community rally behind it. On the contrary, you have expressed that you have a problem. So most funders, foundations, institutions, and bigger funders will lean back and say, whoa, we're going to wait how that one plays out before we give money. And I applaud the mayor for his concern, but I want to say that I am sure that neither Opera Boston, and I know that we do not receive any funding from the city of Boston. And that is for other reasons. But had we gone to the press, in our case, I think I would consider that probably the last cannon that we would shoot on a sinking ship. And it just would resound a little more loudly. I think it would just speed up the demise. If we were in that position, that would not be the solution. It is, in fact, when you do have a problem, it's within your core group of donors and friends. It's like with life. When you're in a desperate situation, you're not going to go to the press. You're going to go to friends, and you hope that they will help you out when you cannot no longer reduce your expenses.
I appreciate the frank answer. That was great. I normally don't get answers that honest in my business. We'll try to sneak in one more question. We're officially over our time, but one more question.
Arthur Smith, I was just wondering if the panel had any take on the New York City Opera situation and whether this will or won't work or whether it's effectively.
Do you want to briefly describe it for anyone who doesn't know?
Moving out of the house, doing a season across the city of New York, a lot of dissent among, I guess, internal and external parties in New York opera scene about whether this is crazy or visionary.
First of all, I understand that a settlement was reached between the unions and City Opera. I wish them very well. I hope that they will continue, and they're out of a house. I think they will succeed if the community rallies behind them, if, in fact, positive momentum can now be created going forward. I cannot comment on internal strife. I cannot comment because I'm not at liberty to know the inner workings, as I do not know about Opera Boston, nor do I wish to, nor is it my place to know, including New York City Opera. So I think there is hope. It'll be a different type of company. It is sad, of course, in many, many ways. One thing that I think in the sadness, and I mentioned, alluded to the loss of the community, it's a loss for the artists, as it is any time a company shrinks or goes out of business. It's so and so many musicians who will not have work as much as they did before. It's so and so many singers who won't have work. It's so and so many designers, it's production staff.
You want to give your community as much work. Then you attract better professionals within the community. So other than that, I really probably I don't know any more than that. But again, positive momentum, forward thinking, and I think they will survive.
May we all. Who's seeing an opera in the course of the next month? All right, well, if this room is in any way indicative of the rest of the population of the metropolitan area, I think we're good to go. Thank you so much.